thanks for also inviting me. As I was just talking with Benjamin, I'd love to visit Perimeter in real life at some point. But this is, I guess, a nice close second. First, just to point out, there's no way you could know this maybe, but the K in the KU Leuven is now officially no longer associated to Catholic anymore. It's just a K. Of course, historically it was Catholic, but they're trying to distance themselves from that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So I would like to tell you a story about some recent work that I've been doing about fuzzball shadows. Okay, and I'll explain what these terms are. So this is this recent work that with a variety of co-authors from a variety of places, a variety of research areas as well. They're basically astrophysicists involved with it. But first, before I do that, I'm going to try to tell you a little bit more about sort of the big picture idea that's behind this work and how it fits into a larger picture, a larger sort of research project or research area. And that's going to be more based on the bigger idea of fuzzballs and observations, which is going to be based on a little bit on my review last year. So what you see here is some picture of a starry sky that's been deformed by a fuzzball, right? So if you have a black hole in the middle here, this would be some black circle, and you would see some deformation around it, but it would be entirely black in the middle. And then when you replace it by a fuzzball, you see this interesting structure here, right? And that's what we're going to be talking about in the part of the talk that I talk about the shadows. So yes, please do interrupt with questions, although I realize that a lot of the things that I talk about, you can go very far in talking about them. And so just because I kind of have this particular story that I want to tell, we might have to wait until the end for questions that go a little bit too far. Okay, so like I said, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about fuzzballs and in particular fuzzballs and observations, how these things can match or be relevant for each other. And also talk just very briefly about the EHT, which is the Event Horizon Telescope, which is the one observation that I kind of want to make a little contact with our fuzzball shadows, right? And so then I'm going to talk about our paper here. Okay, let me just get started, right? So in GR, we have black holes. We know this. Classical general relativity, we have black holes. In quantum gravity, I think, especially here, right, there's a lot of different approaches, a lot of different ideas of how to approach quantum gravity. But we're kind of all maybe in agreement, hopefully, that something should happen to a black hole in GR, right? At the very least, there's something wrong with the singularity at the center of black holes, right? Because we lose predictability there. And so we don't really know what the theory or what should happen at the singularity, right? This is sort of at a very basic level. Okay, now of course you can discuss endlessly what exactly you want to expect in place of a classical black hole, but I think the lesson that people take in phenomenology is there should be something that changes, right? Black holes are strong gravity, and this gives us sort of the best window into what quantum gravity effects that we have. Okay, and so how do you model sort of something that you don't really know yet what it should be? Well, what people typically do is you take the black hole in your favorite observation, maybe some kind of a merger of two black holes. You take a black hole and you actually replace it by something else. You replace it by something that is very close to being a black hole. So it's something that is very compact, right? If it had a much bigger extent than the black hole, then you would immediately see effects of that in observations, of course. So it has to be really, really compact, but it can't have a horizon, right? It's something that doesn't have a horizon, but it's very, very compact. So it has to be exotic, because if you make it too compact, then there has to be something exotic, some exotic mechanism that keeps it from collapsing under its own weight. Okay, you can sort of parameterize this in a very generic way by saying, if you have some black hole with some mass and spin or whatever, it has a horizon radius, right? A horizon scale. And so this horizon scale RH, you then expect this compact object, this exotic compact object, your echo, to have a scale at which it starts differing from your black hole metric that is a little bit bigger than the horizon scale, okay? And so this scale would be R0, and you can sort of parameterize it with this 1 plus epsilon here, epsilon being something that you then expect to be, has to be bigger than zero, because it's the object is going to be bigger than the black hole, but you expect it to be much, much smaller than one, right? This is going to be some small parameter. And just to give you an idea, if you only have classical GR, your epsilon parameter has to be pretty big. It has to be 1/8, right? Whereas when we're talking about things that are, you know, really compact, this epsilon has to be very, very, very small, right? 10 to the minus something. Okay, I mean, very, very sort of hand wavy, right? It's not really important to be exact here. And also, it's also something, you know, this phenomenology that people do is also not a very exact kind of thing, right? We have a lot of different echo models that have a lot of different epsilons, sometimes small, sometimes a little bit bigger. And of course, we have no way really of distinguishing or choosing one, favoring one model over the other. Most models that are used are things that are bottom-up models, okay, ad hoc models, things like boson stars, wormholes, these kind of things. Okay, when I say wormholes, I don't mean the wormholes from islands in string theory that are recently being talked about or anything like that. I really mean you take the Schwarzschild metric, for example, or Kerr, you go in by hand and you change some of the metric components so that it doesn't have a horizon anymore, but it turns into a wormhole with a second asymptotic region. Boson stars are different things. This is basically saying you have Einstein gravity plus some scalar field with some scalar potential. And then, you know, under certain conditions, the scalar field can sort of condense and form these horizonless compact objects that are sort of very close to black holes in certain regimes. But the problem with these and with a lot of echo models is that there's not really any motivation. There's not really any way of choosing one over the other. You don't know if what you're doing makes sense, especially with the wormholes. This is clear, right? You're just changing metric components by hand. You're just kind of doing what you can to see what the effect is of getting rid of a horizon and replacing it by something else. So what I would like to argue is that, you know, it's a prime place for something, for an object that is motivated in a top-down kind of fashion, right? That comes from a quantum gravity theory, from a UV complete quantum gravity theory that we know has a very good, that we know the physics of all the way, you know, up to any scale that you want. And in particular has a nice embedding in string theory, right? So that's what I'm going to be thinking of. And this is exactly what a fuzzball is, okay? I'll say a little bit more about where fuzzballs come from in a minute. But these fuzzballs, you know, from this phenomenological point of view, this is a string theory object that has horizon scale microstructure, right? So that means that it's one of these compact objects that replaces a horizon by something that has that's a little bit bigger than a horizon. And so I think a very natural, very interesting question is, you know, if I replace black holes by fuzzballs, what kind of observable signals can this have, right? In the same way that people look at these other echo models, but now at least we have some kind of a top-down motivation or understanding of these objects. So let me say a little bit more about fuzzballs, right? So where do fuzzballs come from? In a very, very brief way, right, to introduce these, they come from thinking of the information paradox. Okay, the information paradox, again, very briefly, you can give entire lectures about this, is essentially saying you form a black hole by throwing a bunch of stuff together and it collapses and forms a black hole. Okay, there's information, in other words, in the stuff that forms the black hole. However, the only stuff that can come out of a black hole is Hawking radiation. Okay, and Hawking radiation is thermal and carries no information. So after a while, you expect that, you know, the black hole is completely evaporated and all you're left with is some thermal radiation that contains no information. And so the problem is, right, the question is, where did the information go that you put into the black hole? It seems like it's evaporated into informationless radiation. So this is sort of the nutshell of the information paradox, at least the way I'm presenting it here. And so the first thing that you might think is, you know, well, Hawking's calculation, right? This is some semi-classical calculation done on a fixed background. And so, you know, what you really need to be doing is a full quantum gravity calculation. And when you do this, you might have small corrections to Hawking's calculation, which can accumulate over time and give you the information, recover the information. Now, I think a very powerful theorem that Mathur proved some years ago is that such small corrections to Hawking's calculation, which translates roughly into small corrections at the horizon scale, that cannot be enough to recover the information, okay? This is sort of a surprising and powerful result. And so you're sort of led to one of three ways out to solve this information paradox, if you will. One way is the idea of remnants. So maybe Hawking's radiation keeps, you know, it radiates away the black hole. There's no information in the radiation. And after a while, you have some kind of a Planck size remnant that contains all the information of the original black hole. Okay, so this is certainly possible in a logical sense, but I think this is sort of unsatisfactory because it would mean you have to cram arbitrarily large amounts of information into arbitrarily small remnants. A second idea is the idea that, so Mathur's theorem assumes that everything is local, that all the interactions are local. And so if you introduce non-local effects, even small non-local effects, you can have, you can circumvent this theorem and you can sort of solve the information paradox. I think it's sort of clear, by the way, that there are many paradigms in which we see non-locality very clearly in string theory. And so I think this is certainly something that is going to be true in quantum gravity, at least in string theory, and is going to be true in resolving the black hole information paradox. So one example is the Papadopoulos-Raju paradigm in ADS-CFT. And there's a lot of other ideas of non-locality. So I would say also, for example, the islands, the whole island story fits within a sort of a modern extension of the Papadopoulos-Raju ideas. However, the third option, which is the one I want to focus on, is, well, if small corrections at the horizon scale are not enough, then there should probably be large corrections at the horizon scale, okay? And so in a very broad, generic, and vague sense, I admit, the idea of fuzzballs or the fuzzball paradigm is that there is new physics at the horizon scale, okay? There is, instead of a horizon, you really replace the whole black hole with its horizon by fuzzballs, which have some microstructure, some fuzzy quantum stringy structure that extends all the way to the horizon scale, right? It's not just localized around the singularity, it extends all the way to the horizon scale. So finally, I'd like to say that, you know, I've presented this sort of as an either or kind of situation, but like I tried to hint at with the non-local effects, I think there could be certainly some kind of combination of these effects as well in the full story of things. I think that too often people assume that things can be mutually exclusive, whereas I think we can learn from different approaches much more than we have been. In any case, the fuzzball paradigm is having large corrections at horizon scales. Okay, there's also other arguments. I won't go into them here, but there's other arguments why you would expect this. Right, it's not just as simple as saying, well, okay, small corrections are not enough, so let's introduce large corrections. There's a question, I think.
Daniel, are you going to review the argument why, you know, about the small corrections are not enough? What you mean by that, and what's the gist of the argument for that?
Right. I wasn't going to do that because that would certainly take me too far away from what I'm. I mean, this isn't really the key point of my story anyway. This is sort of just trying to say, I'm trying to sort of give you a rough idea of where things come from. If you want, maybe after my talk, I can tell you a little bit more about, you know, why would you expect, I think a question that I often get is, you know, why would you expect large corrections at horizon scales, for example, in the collapsing shell of matter, because, you know, the curvatures stay well under control until that it gets to the singularity scale. And so things like that, I can give you some arguments for that might be interesting, but that might take me a little bit too far away right now, if that's okay.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So we can revisit those questions maybe later. For now, you know, maybe let's just take this as a given, right? That in string theory, you have this paradigm, which is in some cases very well understood. In other cases, much less, right? But there are some cases where we understand this idea very, very well, right? There are some black holes, let's say, that we understand very well how to replace it by these fuzzballs that have horizon scale microstructure. Okay, so what I mean by that is it's more than just me waving my hands in a sense and saying, well, there's large corrections at the horizon scale, right? There's a lot more meat that you can put behind it, but I'm not gonna go into detail right now. Now, I would like to make a small distinction now, right? So when I talk about fuzzballs, I've sort of made it very general as a statement. And so the very general statement is that these things are microstates of a black hole. Okay, so this is maybe something I haven't really said yet. But the idea also of fuzzballs is not only is it you know, replacing a black hole, it's also somehow a necessity of seeing a black hole as a statistical ensemble, right? If you have a black hole, it has some kind of an entropy, right? It has an area, so it has an entropy. And so you want to interpret this as some kind of an ensemble average geometry in some sense. And so then the question is, you know, if the black hole is corresponds to an ensemble or an average over states, what are these individual states in gravity? If nothing else, this is obviously a very interesting question, right? What is one individual microstate of a black hole in gravity? Okay, and so in the fuzzball program, I will call one individual microstate a fuzzball. And so very crucially, the charges of this object, of this fuzzball, have to be the same as the black hole, right? It's sort of in the same ensemble, and so it has the same mass and charges. But as opposed to a black hole, a fuzzball is going to be horizonless, right? This is sort of the whole setup. Now, the general fuzzball is going to be something that is going to be a very quantum and stringy object in general, right? If I have some kind of an arbitrary random microstate of the black hole, there's no reason to expect that this is going to be some well-behaved geometry that I can study using normal classical or semi-classical approximations. And so we're only really able to study sort of these general quantum fuzzballs with very generic arguments, because we don't really have access to studying them in any more direct way. However, microstate geometries, and so I'm introducing this concept now, are very specific fuzzballs where we can do exactly that, right? We can write down an explicit solution, an explicit geometry solution in supergravity to represent this particular fuzzball. So these are very special microstates, of course, because they are geometries, they are semi-classical states, they are coherent states, which are by their very nature very, very special states. And so that's something you need to keep in mind, of course, that, you know, the geometries that we can actually study and actually look at, these microstate geometries, are very special states in this whole space of fuzzballs. Okay. So what we're going to be studying when we think about actual fuzzballs and we want to be taking them seriously in some gravity theory are really going to be these microstate geometries. And so it's important, like I said, to be in touch with the limitations that we have of the existing microstate geometries. Right. So the first thing that you should know is that these things are really hard to construct. These are very complicated solutions in supergravity typically. And so we use any tools that we can to help us construct them. Typically, this means supersymmetry, right? So a lot of microstate geometries are supersymmetric. There's a lot less of them, but there are still some examples of non-supersymmetric microstate geometries, which is nice. But it's fair to say that for realistic black holes, and then I'm talking about, you know, Schwarzschild or Kerr, there's no such thing as a microstate geometry that corresponds to a microstate of these guys. Okay. And so this is, I think, a very big limitation for the microstate geometry program, especially when you think of observations. Another limitation is simply that since they're very hard geometries to study, dynamical questions are also very hard to attack. Things like formation, evolution of these geometries is something that is very ill understood, and we don't really know exactly how this works. We expect that it will also, you know, you'll have to have more access to the full phase space. You'll have to admit things like topology changes in your geometry, which is something we don't really know how to take care of in a dynamical sense. And finally, something that I sort of said already is that these microstate geometries are these coherent special semi-classical states. And so you might think that, you know, a typical fuzzball, a typical microstate, which is some, you know, random microstate that you take out of the ensemble, is going to be maybe very different in some observational properties in them, right? And so then the question that you can ask, which I think is a very good question, is, you know, how much do you learn about typical fuzzballs, about the actual fuzzballs that you might see in the sky from, you know, considering things like semi-classical coherent microstate geometries? Okay, so all of these things for me, I mean, they may seem depressing, but I think for me, this really means that we need to take the following viewpoint, okay? We have these microstate geometries available to us, but we know that they're limited by the things that I just mentioned. So we should consider these as some kind of a toy model, okay? And so we study the microstate geometries that we have, we understand what kind of properties they have, but we try to identify things that we then expect to be universal and maybe carry over to the entire phase space of fuzzballs, okay? And this can qualitatively point us to observables that might be interesting for actual observations, okay? So one example of such a universal property, right, because this might be a little bit vague or abstract at the moment, one example of such a property is the actual structure or mechanism of microstate geometries, meaning the reason that they exist and don't just collapse under their own weight or anything. Okay, you have a black hole, which has some kind of a redshift throat, right? It's sort of infinite redshift at the horizon. But in this, in microstate geometries, the horizon is replaced by a cap, right? A cap meaning the space-time just sort of pinches off smoothly and ceases to exist, which is the microstructure exactly of this, of this, of this fuzzball. The cap has to be, you know, you need to do something with this cap so that it doesn't just collapse under itself. And the something that that keeps this cap, this microstructure from collapsing is always, in all the examples we know, it's always non-trivial topology. Okay, the space-time in the extra dimensions beyond, you know, four, if you will, does something very, very non-trivial, has some topological bubbles, right? S2s in them in very non-trivial ways. And in such a way that it keeps somehow this microstructure open. Okay, so this is a very, right, we have the explicit examples that we have are these very special supersymmetric microstate geometries, et cetera, but everything that we have is always using the same kind of mechanism, right? So this is sort of an idea, one of the ideas that you could have of a universal property, right? That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Okay, and so finally, you know, what I want to, So what am I really trying to say, right? What I'm saying is that I think we should think of fuzzball phenomenology, right? If I'm allowed to use that term, in which we think of fuzzballs as these, if nothing else, right? These are top-down quantum gravity motivated explicit solutions in some supergravity theory that correspond to these echoes, right? These compact objects that can replace black holes. And so we could think of these as toy models and try to identify universal properties, robust features, et cetera, of these microstate geometries. Okay, and so I give the a little aside here that this is not something that we do, that this is not something new, right? This idea, this philosophy, we did this also, or we do this also in things like holographic QCD, ADS QCD, where, for example, you know, we look at strongly coupled gauge theories that are not QCD, but do have a holographic dual, and we try to understand if they have some universal features, which we then want to understand as universal features of strongly coupled gauge theories. And so, for example, I think one of the triumphs of this program is the famous eta over S ratio, right? The viscosity over entropy ratio, which in holographic strongly coupled field theories, we see very easily that this has to be, you know, 1/4 pi, a very small number. In experiments, we also see that this seems to be a very small number, this particular observable. But in, you know, first principle QCD calculations, this is something that was basically unobtainable, right? Not understandable, and something that is very hard to make sense out of. So I think this was one of the triumphs of ADS QCD, I would argue. And it's this kind of idea or philosophy that I would like to have with this fuzzball phenomenology as well. So just to be clear, I think this is really a two-step process, right? The first step is, like I said, you take these microstate geometries that you have seriously, and you do some kind of a phenomenological study of them, right? You think of, you know, what does it mean when I collide two of them, or I look at one of them and I do observations on them. And that points your way, that inspires you to see these universal features, which you can then model in a general way, and understand or model these general string theory inspired effects, and see if you can constrain them in future observations or see them in future observations. And so I think these are new ideas. This is a new field. You know, there are only a few people and groups doing this at the moment. And so I have, you know, many ideas, and I'd be very happy to talk about them if anybody's interested. Okay, so this is sort of the end of my introduction of fuzzballs. I just have one slide on the EHT just to set the scene, you know, if people are not familiar with this or with some of the details that I'd like to talk about in a minute. So the EHT is the Event Horizon Telescope, okay? And the Event Horizon Telescope is basically a bunch of telescopes all over the Earth, which work together as one virtual Earth-sized telescope. And so what does it do? It looks at black holes. It's looked at one black hole so far, with another one coming up, I guess, and it produces images of them. Okay, so it looks at them with just electromagnetic radiation and produces images like the one that we see over here of M87, or the black hole in the middle of M87. Of course, a black hole doesn't actually radiate, right? A black hole is black. And so what we see here is really the effects of the plasma of the accretion disk around the black hole. And in particular, since this is plasma, it means it's charged particles. And so it radiates charged particles that accelerate, radiate. And so that's exactly the kind of things that we see. We see the radiation that travels around the black hole in some complicated geodesic orbits before coming out to the camera, to the telescope, to give us the image that we see. And so because, you know, because it's sort of the photons that we see give us information because they come from so close to the horizon and they've traveled maybe around the black hole a bit, or close to the black hole, they supposedly give us information, detailed information about the structure of the black hole, about the near horizon geometry of the black hole. Now, unfortunately, the real case is a little bit more complicated because we actually have very, very a lot of uncertainty in the actual plasma physics. So what that means is, you know, when you want to reproduce an image like this, or you want to understand, you know, what geometry gives this kind of image, what you do is you take some GRMHD simulation, which means some magnetohydrodynamics on some black hole background, and you evolve it, and then you see that there's radiation that comes out and gets bent by gravity, and then you get a picture that looks like this, right? And then after you add it through some blurring filters to mimic the telescope, you get an image that looks more like this, which you then match with the actual image. Now, the problem is that the resolution, et cetera, of the telescope is low, and the uncertainty in the plasma physics is so high that actually when we vary many of the parameters of the plasma, which we can't really fix in any other way, we see that we can still reproduce the right image, so to speak, for many different parameter ranges, let's say, of the plasma. What that all means is that we're very insensitive at the moment. The images are very insensitive to the actual details of the geometry, right? So it's very hard to make detailed statements about geometry based on these images as of now. And so a very good question is then, you know, if there's microstructure at the horizon, how are you going to really be seeing this, right? I think at the moment, this is hard. I'll give you an idea of how we might be able to see this in some future observations, not necessarily at EHT, at the very end. But for now, I think this is definitely a problem that I want to point out. Of course, the level zero, let's say, approach or idea that you or problem that we should solve is to understand the effect of geodesics around such a black hole geometry. And so also, since I'm talking about fuzzballs, I want to understand the behavior of geodesics, you know, in and around a fuzzball. Okay, and so that's what I'm going to be talking about. Okay, so maybe, I don't know if there are any brief questions here before I go on to the actual shadow paper. Also gives me a chance to have a sip of water. Okay, so if there's no questions on that. So the idea now is that I'm going to really talk about, in this context of fuzzballs, in this context of imaging, where we have the EHT sort of in the back of our mind, I'm going to talk about images of fuzzballs, okay? Images or shadows of fuzzballs. And so the two main questions that I'm going to try to address are going to be, first of all, you know, if the black hole is black, obviously, like I just said, it absorbs photons. Now, if a fuzzball doesn't have a horizon, sort of by definition, everything that goes into it has to come out again. So that seems to be in direct contradiction with the fact that a fuzzball should be mimicking a black object, right? A black hole. So how will a fuzzball achieve this effective blackness in the first place? Right? How will it mimic a black hole? So that's going to be the first question that I want to address with our studies of these images. And then the second question, once we ascertain or understand how a fuzzball does look effectively black, I then want to go on to the question, well, okay, if we have an image, how do I distinguish a black hole from a fuzzball image? Okay, and that's sort of making contact a little closer to observations. Okay, so the actual setup that I'm going to be using is not super important because the statements that I'm going to be doing, the story that I'm going to tell is going to be very generic, very general. However, just so that, you know, so I'm not going to flash a metric for you because I think that would scare people away anyway and not be very illuminative. What I will say is just a few words about the setup, just in case you are familiar with these kind of things. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be using a particular geometry in the family of multicenter geometries, so force space-time dimensions, just like the real world. It's going to be a supersymmetric geometry, although, again, that's not going to be very important for the whole story. And so the only reason why I'm showing this is because you'll be able to see this kind of center structure in the images. And so the structure that there is, right, these centers, if you will, are going to be two centers that are sort of placed on the z-axis. And then in the equatorial plane, there's what we call a ring center here. Okay, and again, I'm not going to tell you more details about what these centers represent or anything. The only reason why I'm even telling you about, you know, what the structure of these centers is because you'll be able to see sort of echoes of this structure in the images that I'm about to show. Okay, and so how do we image the actual geometry? What's the way that we do this? Well, the first thing that I want to show you is this idea of a four-color screen. Okay, so what do? We imagine that we have a very large sphere, very large radius. We place our camera at one of the, at sort of an edge of this sphere. So in particular, this white dot here that you see. And we place our object in the center of the sphere, right? So the black hole or the fuzzball, we place at the center of the sphere. And then we imagine that this sphere emits light towards the center. And it emits light of a certain color depending on where the light originates from, right? So just like you can see here, either red, green, yellow, or blue. And so then, of course, the light from these sphere parts will travel through the space-time, get bent by the central object, and eventually end up in our camera. And so then the question that you can ask is, you know, what's the picture that you see? Okay, now, of course, if the space-time would just be flat, the only thing that you would see would just be sort of this red, green, blue, and yellow quadrants in your image. If you have something else, then you see something a little bit more complicated. Okay, so in particular, right, this is gonna be sort of the main slide I'm gonna be talking about in terms of images. So let's just focus on this first row for a minute. And let's first look at this, at the last column in this row, which is simply a black hole. Now, what I was talking about before, right? So what I've plotted here is simply the image that your camera sees due to this sort of four-colored sphere that's at infinity. And again, if you have just flat space like you do very far away from the black hole, then all you see is just sort of light that traveled unimpeded from your sphere all the way to your camera. And so that's what gives you these far away red, green, yellow, blue areas. If you go a little bit closer to the central object, in this case, it's a black hole, you see that the light can bend around the black hole and sort of do something interesting before it comes to the camera. And so for example, you know, this ring that you see around the black hole, this very thick ring is of course just simply a light that has traveled from, you know, the region, the yellow region, let's say, traveled halfway around, right? Had traveled sort of bent around the black hole before traveling towards the camera. And that's why there's this yellow over here. So this tells us a lot about the bending of light and sort of how light gets bent by the space-time. Of course, what you see here in the black hole geometry is there's a big black circle in the middle because it's a black hole, and therefore anything that goes too close to it gets absorbed by the horizon, never comes out again. So it's black. Now let's look at the other rows, or the other columns rather, where you see there's this parameter lambda. And so again, it's not going to be super important for us what this parameter lambda is. In the language of these multi-center geometries, it's called a scaling parameter. Now, again, it's not going to be very, very, very important for us. But the important thing to know is that lambda going to zero, as lambda approaches zero, you approach the black hole. Okay, and this is, you can, you know, make this very, very concrete in your sort of microstate geometry setup. You have some family of microstate geometries parameterized by lambda, which all have the same charges at infinity. But as you decrease lambda, your redshift throat becomes longer and longer, and your geometry approaches more and more the black hole geometry. The strict lambda going equals to zero limit is sort of a singular limit. But if you take it seriously, then that gives you exactly the black hole. Okay, so there's a well-defined sense in which lambda getting smaller corresponds to getting closer and closer to the black hole geometry. Although for every lambda that's larger than zero, right, so for every one of these microstate geometries, there is no horizon, and we're really talking about some smooth horizonless fuzzball object. All right, so the first thing that you see when you look at these microstate geometry pictures, especially the ones on the left here, where you can see it very clearly, is that the sort of interior of the black hole, if I want to call it that, right? So that is basically saying, you know, the interior here, that's the light rays that normally would get trapped by the horizon of the black hole, but now are exploring the microstructure of this fuzzball before getting emitted back out, right? Before coming back out. And so what you see is that this is a very chaotic procedure, right? That's what all of these small different color regions tell you, right? If you move the geodesic just a little bit, then it travels on a very different path. And so that's exactly the sign of chaos, right? So there's chaos, there's these chaotic trajectories that these light rays, these photons, these geodesics travel on when they explore the microstructure inside, let's say, the horizon scale. So that's the first thing that you can see here. The second thing, which you can see in this second row here, the second thing that you can see is that these chaotic orbits take a very, very long time exploring the microstructure. Okay, so what do I plot here? Here, I keep track of each geodesic and how long in coordinate time, right, asymptotic coordinate time, how long it takes this geodesic to exit the microstructure, to explore the microstructure. And so the yellower the pixel gets, the longer it's taken for it to come out. Of course, if you have a black hole, the stuff that goes in the horizon takes forever to come out, and that's why it's completely yellow, right? And so what you see here, again, is that, you know, as you decrease lambda, as you get closer to this black hole limit, the geodesics that go in the microstructure explore the microstructure in more and more chaotic orbits for longer and longer, right? It takes longer and longer for them to come out. So let me write that here. So this is the time that it takes takes for escape. Now, just a little pointer here, right? You may have noticed and wondered about the black dots here, and especially these two microstates here. Okay, so in principle, as I said, since these are horizonless objects, no geodesics will ever be trapped, right? Maybe some measure zero set of geodesics, but whatever. No geodesics will get trapped. They will all come out after some finite time. However, in practice, since we're doing numerical simulations, we need to cut off the simulation at some point. And so we need to say, you know, what is, and so we need to say, you know, if it hasn't come out before some given, you know, finite cutoff time, then we just say, okay, this pixel is black. It hasn't come out in time. And so that's what happens here. The pixels that are colored black here are just taking so long to explore the microstructure that they haven't come out in our finite but large integration time. Okay, so now let's look at the third and fourth rows. The third and fourth rows here are showing, again, we're looking at each individual geodesic, and we're keeping track of how much redshift that the geodesic encounters in this pane. And so you see as it gets bluer, the geodesic encounters more and more redshift. And here, very importantly, we again keep track of how much tidal stress or curvature that each individual geodesic encounters, right? And so, for example, here, right, any geodesic that goes into the horizon of the black hole, of course, has to fall all the way to the singularity, and so it experiences infinite curvature, right? And that's why it's completely white. And in general, if it the brighter the geodesic is, the more curvature it's experienced. And so you can see here that, you know, as you make the fuzzball, the microstate geometry compactor, as lambda gets smaller, as it approaches the black hole more and more, you see that these geodesics that are trapped on long-lived chaotic orbits also experience a lot of tidal stress on their orbits and also a lot of redshift. Okay, so at this point, the narrative, right, that I'd like to propose is that, you know, what happens when these geodesics or when these photons enter this horizon scale microstructure, right, they enter this region here, what happens is that the geodesic approximation will sort of break down after a while. There's a question? From Hank Chen?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just wondering, like, as you tune lambda to zero, presumably you approximate the black hole, but at lambda 0.01, for example, like the edges of the black hole, mm-hmm. perhaps more long-living geodesics or long-traveling geodesics instead of the center. So,
okay, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if you're asking if the geodesics.
Like why? Yeah.
Are you asking why these geodesics take a long time to come out, or?
Well, they start to, I don't know, like you see the, well, what I see is that the edges of the horizon essentially traps more long-living geodesics instead of the center. So
I don't think I would say that, right? I would say that it's also a little bit, you know, when you talk about microstructure, it becomes a little bit fuzzy to talk about like what is the edge or what is not. But when I just look at the images, right, what you have is, of course, you have these are going to be the photon rings, right, which is sort of the edge of this of what would be the horizon. And there you're going to have an infinite series of these photon rings where photons go around for more and more times. But that's really not what's going on inside, right? So that's something that I think, you know, that will mimic the black hole and mimic the fact that you can have photons going around arbitrarily many times. That's really not what we're seeing inside, right? I think that's really a distinctive thing than the things that we see inside the microstructure, right? The stuff that if it was a black hole, it would have gotten trapped is now doing something completely different, right? It's now on these chaotic orbits. I think that's really something different than these photon rings, which are what you see that, you know, sort of orbit the black hole many times before coming out.
I see. So, yeah, well, I mean, it's just that essentially black hole intuition about the black hole doesn't really hold for finite land. Yeah, I see.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so the narrative that I'd like to build up is that what happens with these photons that go into the microstructure, right? What happens to them? Well, they go on these long-lived orbits, chaotic orbits, with a lot of tidal stress. And what these tidal stresses will do after a while is they will break down the geodesic approximation. In particular, there's arguments from other places, other explicit calculations in fuzzball geometries that suggest that actually what's going to happen is, you know, a photon is like a massless excitation of a string, right? It's a massless mode of a string. And so what happens when you have these tidal stresses pulling and pushing on it is it wants the string wants to get excited. Its massive excitations want to get excited. And so what will happen is this string, this photon will actually change into some effectively massive particle, which will trap it, right? This will trap it. This will make it interact with the fuzzball background. And so if you take this a little further, what's going to happen is the massless particles, the photons go in, they're trapped by this mechanism of tidal stresses pushing and pulling on it, making it massive, making it sort of part of the fuzzball, perturbing the initial fuzzball. The only thing that can then come out after a while, because you've now effectively trapped the initial particles, the only thing that can come out is, let's say, photons that are radiated away from exactly these places where you've interacted with the microstructure. So exactly where there's a lot of tidal stress is where you would be emitting these photons. And since as you can see in these images, the places of large tidal stress are also the places of large redshift, what you're going to be seeing in the end is going to be photons that are emitted from these large redshift places. And so they will be, once they get out of the microstructure, they will be redshifted sort of away, right? They will be redshifted into very low energy photons, right? So the entire story is really this idea, I guess I could go to the next slide, this idea that this effective blackness is a result of photons going in, being trapped on these long-lived chaotic orbits that encounter large tidal forces, which make it something else, right? Make it a massive object, perturb the fuzzball, whatever. And then this perturbed fuzzball will then, if anything, right, it'll emit some radiation that has to be highly redshifted before it comes out. And so that's how you effectively get something black, because the only thing that you end up seeing of the photons or any objects that sort of fall in and explore the microstructure, the only thing that you can see are these highly redshifted photons that come out from the microstructure. And so that's how it can be effectively, right? Effectively, this means it'll look black to us. Okay, so this is sort of the idea that we like to propose, right? Of course, there's a lot more that one can do about this. One can put more meat on this and try to understand, you know, what kind of source terms do I add to the geodesic equation to mimic exactly the story of the tidal forces making the photon something massive and then emitting some other redshifted particles, right? There's more games that you can play. At the moment, we've only really done this imaging procedure where we shot geodesics at the fuzzball and kept track of the time and the redshift and the tidal stress of each geodesic. Now in the last, I'm actually 5 minutes over, but I guess I started a little late too. So can I have like 5 minutes to wrap up?
Yeah, definitely.
Good. Okay. Good. Okay, so this sort of is the idea, right, where we understand or we think we understand how fuzzballs are effectively black. Now, the next question would be, you know, how can we distinguish them in actual observations from black holes? Okay, so let me skip this because the only real idea here is to say that it's not going to work with just looking at the image. And what you need is something, what you need, right, is something that sees beyond the plasma, right? Remember what I said in the beginning when I was talking about the EHT is there's a lot of uncertainty in the plasma physics, which makes it hard to probe the geometry. Okay, now I think a very promising idea is this idea of photon rings. So the idea here is that you have this object, which are these photon rings. So photon rings, right, if you think of the nth photon ring, this is like the photons that have traveled n times around the black hole before getting spit out, right, before escaping. And so you have, in principle, you have an infinite number of these photon rings, right, because a photon can travel around the black hole arbitrarily many times in a theoretical sense. It so happens that one expects on very general grounds that as long as you look at the higher n photon rings, that this becomes sort of more and more insensitive to the actual details of the plasma physics, which is good. And of course, because you're sort of accumulating small effects of going around the black hole, small effects of the geometry, it becomes very, very sensitive to details of the geometry, which is even better. So these higher order photon rings are things that would be very interesting to look at. Of course, which n you need to be looking at, right? Which n is high enough to be not sensitive to the plasma is something that you maybe need to look at, maybe need to figure out. I think depending on what aspect of these photon rings you're looking at, maybe a different n would be needed. I can go into more detail on that too if necessary. And so one thing to notice is that this is not something that would be seen at the EHT because you need higher resolution but also higher frequencies. And so you really need something that's bigger than the Earth. So you need some kind of a space-based effective telescope. So this would be like a next kind of observation. And so what you can do is one thing that you can look at is the intensity of these rings. Okay, and so what you see here is that the ring profile here of the n is 1, 2, and 3, where you see the intensity versus the width, right? This is sort of a cross section of this horizontal width here. And so what you see is that the n is equals to 1 photon ring, right? The photons that have gone around once is a very broad thing that you sort of very easily see. And then the subsequent rings are going to be exponentially less broad, right? Exponentially narrower, but they also peak a little bit. And so there's still some kind of a measurable flux there. If you want to make this concrete, you can think of the flux, the total flux, right? The total amount of photon flux that you get from the n plus oneth ring compared to the previous ring, right? The flux of the nth ring. This is typically something that is that goes with an exponential decay governed by this Lyapunov exponent. For Schwarzschild, for example, this is simply equals to pi. And so this is a factor of 4%, which means that, you know, the second photon ring is going to be only 4% as bright as the first photon ring, right? So this is really an exponential damping of the brightness. Nevertheless, simply looking at this, the relative brightness of subsequent rings tells you what this exponent is, right? In sort of a reverse way, you can measure this exponent by measuring the fluxes of these subsequent rings. And this exponent depends very, very much on the geometry, right? So like I said, Schwarzschild has just a gamma that's equals to pi. Kerr has a much more complicated formula for this exponent that depends also on sort of the orientation and everything. But what I'd like to show you in this graph here is that, you know, you can imagine if you want to distinguish Kerr from Kerr-Newman, for example, let's say that we have an image and we want to understand whether it's really Kerr or whether it's allowed to have some kind of a charge to this geometry, right? Think of this charge as some dark charge that only interacts, you know, gravitationally with the standard model. So it doesn't interact with the photons except through the metric, right? So we have Kerr versus Kerr-Newman. And it turns out that if you look at this exponent, where I've set, you know, various angles to be something in particular. But if you look at this exponent, and for example, let's just look at this bottom graph here, where I've fixed the rotation, right, to be A over M is 9/10 in Kerr or Kerr-Newman, and then I vary the charge in this black hole from 0, right, so just pure Kerr, to extremal Kerr-Newman, right, the maximal amount of charge allowed. And you can see that this quantity goes from, you know, 8% to something like 13%. So if you have very detailed observations and measurements of this of these relative fluxes, and you can measure this this exponent very, very detailed, then you could really distinguish between Kerr and Newman. Okay, and that's something that we're talking about in our upcoming paper. There was also a paper today that discusses very similar ideas. And so, of course, you know, this is something that I think, you know, if you really want to be serious about distinguishing fuzzballs from black holes, this is something, this is really the thing that you should be looking at, right? And so this is, of course, the thing that we want to look at next is to understand these photon rings for fuzzballs and how they might differ from the corresponding black holes, right? And so make some kind of a observational statement about that. All right, let me just wrap up really, really brief, right? This is just my final slide to summarize. The general kind of philosophy that I wanted to make was this fuzzball phenomenology that I talked about in the beginning, where these fuzzballs are top-down objects that you can consider as quantum gravity motivated compact objects in your phenomenology, right? And so this is something that is very new, and there's a lot of things to be done. And so the particular project that I talked about was this idea of fuzzball shadows, where fuzzballs can mimic a black hole arbitrarily well, having this emerging horizon due to the effects that I talked about with tidal stresses, et cetera. And so I think a very interesting possibility, sort of the next step on the list, is to look at these photon rings and really try to make a case for how or if we can distinguish fuzzballs from their corresponding black holes. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Daniel, for this very interesting talk. And clap for everyone. So are there any questions? And keeping with tradition, we start with students. And I already see a raised hand by Anna. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for the talk. I was just wondering, you said that in some regions we get high redshift radiation leaving the fuzzball, but mm-hmm. you get the massive or the perturbed strings that are massive that are trapped. So could you go into more detail about what happens to the photons in this process? Just a bit more detail.
Right. Okay. So I was vague, and I sort of have to necessarily stay vague because we don't, you know, what we'd like to do also next, right, is to understand this process a little bit better. Now, from other studies, we kind of understand that what typically happens in a microstate geometry when you drop in a massless particle, what typically happens is that this massless particle is really a string in some higher dimensional setting. And so what you typically see is that the tidal forces on this string are exactly such that the string gets excited, the massive modes on the string gets excited, right? So it becomes something massive. And then what you can sort of imagine it doing, right? And this is sort of, I don't have the reference offhand, but if you imagine that this is sort of, right, if this would have been the horizon, it would have gone like this. But if you imagine that there's a particle falling in, and then, you know, here it becomes massive maybe, right? And so instead of sort of just bouncing back up out of the microstructure here at the cap, what it'll do is it'll maybe bounce back up, but then, you know, experience more tidal forces, not be able to escape so much further, go back in. And in the end, you know, it'll be some very massive object that sort of sits at the bottom of this throat here somewhere, right? And so in the end, what you'll get some, I don't know if this really made any sense, right? But what you'll get is something where, you know, you've perturbed this cap by some very massive objects in the end, right? So in the end, this massless object falls in, becomes a little bit more massive, maybe bounces up and down a few times to experience more and more tidal force, right? Bounces up and down means explores the microstructure, right? Bounces up and down a few times before settling down into some state where it's, you know, so massive that it's just sort of really a part of the fuzzball itself. And then at each of these steps, of course, what you can have is you can have some radiation, right, from all these steps. And so the radiation that would escape would be exactly from these highly redshifted places. Right? These are new photons. These are not the original photon that escapes. These are new photons that are produced in some dynamical setting. But since they're escaping from some highly redshifted place, they're going to be very low energy once they escape out of the microstructure. Sorry, I don't know if that answered your question, though.
Right. Yeah. Okay. If they're new photons, then that makes more sense.
New photons. Thanks. Yeah. Good. Okay.
Okay. Any more questions by students? Yes, there's a hand by Manu.
I wanted to get an intuition of what exactly a fuzzball is. So what exactly are the microstructures that we are talking about here? Are there some fields which somehow you tune and go to a classical GR limit or classical black hole limit? Or just to give a picture as to what is the fuzzball made of?
To sort of get a picture of it, I completely understand the idea, right? There's many different ways that I could draw it or understand it. Again, if you think of a black hole as having this sort of redshift throat, right? If I want to draw it like this, it's sort of this infinite redshift, right, at the horizon. So it's like an infinite redshift throat. If a particle falls in, it falls through this whole thing. When you have a fuzzball, you have to cap this off at some finite distance, okay? And so this distance is something that you can typically control in your fuzzball. And so what happens here is you have some kind of a microstructure, right? And so what I was trying to tell you is that this microstructure should be thought of as something topological, right? It's not going to be just some kind of a smooth cap that just goes away in four dimensions. You really need something in the extra dimensions that sort of supports this thing without it just wanting to collapse, right? Because if you had, typically if you think of this kind of a structure, what it wants to do is it wants to just boom, collapse into a black hole again. But what keeps it open is you have these topological bubbles, and on these bubbles, you have some kind of a flux. So you put some electromagnetic fields, let's say, that have a flux on these bubbles. Which keeps the bubbles from collapsing themselves, right? So if you have some kind of a bubble, typically it will also want to collapse under its own weight. But if you have some kind of a magnetic flux on them, for example, then the magnetic flux, you know, can't just go, you know, can't just disappear. And so there's sort of this tension between the gravitational and the electromagnetic forces on this bubble that keep it open. And this generalizes to, you know, more complicated fuzzball and stuff like that. I'm not sure if this sort of answers your question, right? So there's this notion of which it looks very different from a black hole. But of course, if you can tune this length here, then what you're basically saying is, you know, if you could put this structure way down in the throat, well, then all of this here is going to mimic exactly the black hole, right? It's going to look very much like the black hole. It'll only start differing when you get really, really, really close to the horizon, when you get really, really deep down this redshift throat. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. I had one more question about, means maybe a little towards the observation side. Means like you have been exploring the shadows for seeing for signatures of the fuzzball, but other means I've seen papers where for the other echoes, the exotic compact objects, people have been working on the modifications in the gravitational wave signals that you detect at LIGO.
Yes.
So is there something along those lines, work going on along those lines to see some changes in the, or maybe there are some echoes due to some exotic compact objects in the current literature, something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And that's, I mean, so that's, I mean, that would be, I can talk for hours about this, right? But this is this whole idea that, you know, you can use these fuzzballs and everything, right? And in particular, I think this shadow imaging, this is all a very small part of this. I think a very exciting thing is to ask yourself questions about the merger, for example, right? And so I can, you know, I can talk about this for a long time, right? But there's let's say there's a lot of things that can happen when you replace a black hole by a fuzzball or any other compact object in the gravitational wave signal. I think it's fair to say that we've only sort of just begun exploring these consequences. One of the reasons is it's very hard, right? Because fuzzballs are very difficult objects. Another reason is because, well, part of the hardness is you don't know their dynamics very well. So it's very hard to do this. But nevertheless, we already have some insights, right? We know that in the ring down signal, right, once you've formed a final object, in general, you expect compact objects to have after the initial ring down, like that's the same as the black hole, right? So I'm talking about this. The merger signal is something like this, and then you have the merger, and then there's an exponential relaxation. If it's a black hole, there's nothing over here, right, after the ring down. If you have a compact object, you typically think there might be some kind of reflection off this structure and give you echoes, right? Not the ECOs, but the actual echoes of the signal, Right. And so there's a recent paper that sort of explores this for fuzzballs, right? And shows you the echo structure that you might expect for some microstate geometries, how it changes when you make this lambda parameter smaller, et cetera. And so there's many more things like that too, but there's also many more things to be done, right? There's so many things that you can do that I think there's a lot of things just waiting to be explored. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any more questions by students or by more senior people as well? I don't see any hands at the moment. Maybe I can ask one or two questions. Maybe in the beginning I missed that, but what is your motivation exactly to have something horizonless?
Right. Well, I mean, okay. So there's many ways that you can think of solving the information paradox, et cetera, and also many ways that you can think of black holes with their entropy. The maybe too simplistic view that I somewhat have is that, you know, a black hole has a horizon. Something with a horizon has an entropy, and therefore corresponds to, you know, something that has many microstates because it has an entropy, right? So it's a thermodynamic ensemble, and so something that And so if you want something that is just one microstate, well, it had better be horizonless, because otherwise it itself will have some kind of entropy and correspond to some coarse graining over microstates. That would be sort of my one line simplistic idea there.
Okay, makes sense. And maybe also you showed us some pictures and there was kind of dipole structure. Where did that come from? I would have expected exactly there. You have these four quadrants of different colors. So I would expect kind of two set two symmetries, two Murrow symmetries, right? But you get only one of them and there's some dipole. So where is this coming from?
Good. So in general, when you have some kind of a general microstate geometry, you would actually expect that there'd be really no symmetries left. Now we happen to take something that is axisymmetric. And so you do have some kind of a symmetry there. We also take something that is equatorial symmetric. This is all accidental or sort of, you know, for convenience. But the equatorial symmetry obviously means that you have this one Z2, as you say, between up and down. It's interesting to note indeed that you can see that there's not a symmetry between left and right. Now, this is basically because the microstates that we're considering here are all rotating. If you look at the black hole, the black hole is not rotating because it's a supersymmetric black hole and they have to be static in four dimensions. And so that is characterized by this sort of symmetry between left and right. Whereas every one of these microstates at finite lambda, this is again sort of an artifact of the particular microstate geometries that we're using. Every one of these has a small but finite angular momentum. And so when you image a object that is rotating, right, even if it would have been Kerr, right, you see some kind of effect in this by breaking the left-right symmetry. And that's exactly the effect that you see for larger lambda, this gets larger. And so you see it the best, for example, in this picture over here. Yeah.
Okay. There's a raised hand by Laurent. Please go ahead.
Hi, Daniel. I have a question maybe more about the beginning and the philosophy, because when you mentioned this microstate and quantum gravity, I wanted to ask you about how do you relate this picture to the usual picture of microstate in quantum gravity. So let me be more precise. So in non-perturbative quantum gravity, the usual picture that we have of quantum gravitational microstates is that they are kind of a representation states of some, you know, boundary symmetry algebra and things like that. And then you carry out the representation theory. So they really appear as quantum states of specific, let's say, symmetry algebras that you recognize as such. And they, it depends on how you slice it. They don't necessarily, all of them are interpretable in terms of classical geometry. So I'm trying to understand, how do you relate this fuzzball picture to this more, let's say, traditional way, which was not mentioned in your introduction, of understanding microstates
in
quantum
gravity? So I think certainly from my viewpoint or from this phenomenology point of view, the most important thing is that we have a bunch of solutions that we can actually access and study in a semi-classical way, right? And that we have these geometries that we can write down and study. So that's sort of, you know, like if I just think about the larger picture of fuzzball in phenomenology, that's what I'm interested in. Now, of course, if from a more theoretical point of view, I think you're completely right. Right, it's certainly not expectable that that most microstates or typical microstates will be anything that you can interpret or write down as some kind of a semi-classical limit or geometry, right? So I tried to sort of say this, that, you know, the ones that we can write down, these microstate geometries, are these coherent semi-classical states where we have a nice geometry interpretation, but a typical fuzzball, a typical microstate will be something very different, like you say, right? And so I think this is a very good point, right? This is a very good argument to be aware of when you're doing studies of microstate geometries, that, you know, this is in a very real sense, a very special set of microstates, right? Where we have this semi-classical approximation. Does this answer your question somewhat?
Yeah, part of it. Then there's this other picture of how people usually describe microstates as representation states of specific symmetry group. That's yes. Really, you know, where most of the quantum gravity literature has been focused on in the past 15 years. So how does this fuzzball relate to that?
I'm very familiar with exactly what you're referring to. I mean, I'm sure that I didn't really define fuzzball in a very precise way, other than to say that, you know, for me, one fuzzball is equals to one microstate roughly of a black hole. And so in this sense, I guess if you want to interpret this in that kind of representation way, then this should be possible, right? I don't really have anything more to say about that. I mean, I'm not sure if is there some tension that you're asking about, or are you just asking how it might fit in this framework? For the second question, I don't know. For the first one, I guess I don't understand the question.
Yeah, it's more about the second. That is, if you think, you know, your description of fuzzball is very geometrical, but at some point,
yes,
most of quantum gravity is getting us towards a more algebraic description,
yes,
of space-time,
yes,
which you have to,
right,
replace these geometrical descriptions by, and this is the next step. You replace wherever the classical,
yes,
solution by representations, yeah, of specific groups. So,
right,
you know, if you cannot make that jump, it becomes, there's a tension, right? So the tension,
right, okay,
is only if it's not possible for you to kind of make that jump towards a more, you know, algebraic, categorical.
No, what I would say is unless I use these techniques, then I will not be able to move beyond the microstate geometries that I have, right? I think that's maybe the point that I would agree with, in that, you know, typical fuzzballs are not going to be these semi-classical things. And so you need something else. You need some other way of representing them, other way of studying them. And so what would be interesting then is to use these other techniques, these other tools, to be able to understand how to understand these microstates, and also to, well, I guess this is a whole research program, right? To understand how you go from something that has no geometrical interpretation, and then, you know, how do you get an effective geometry, maybe at large distances or something like that, from that. Right? That I think, you know, if we know how to do that for some arbitrary non-geometric microstate, that would be a very interesting thing to study then, also observationally.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Okay, then that's all. Thank Daniel again for his very nice talk.